Hey guys, this is The Conversation. It's episode 164 with Stacy Fabricant. She is a New York-based collector. And if you are looking for that quintessential villainous collector that is so often on the edge of the conversation in this show, among others, I would imagine, she is not it. She is so down to earth and warm and friendly and inviting, literally and figuratively. And she also collects because she loves it, God willing. She's not a flipper, as she points out. And I think you'll appreciate what she has to say, what we have to talk about. I'm Michael Shaw. The website for this podcast, as you may know, is theconversationpod.com, where I encourage you to go see images of numerous works from Stacy's collection installed in her apartment, in the current apartment, that is, in the Village. She, perhaps around the time this comes out or shortly thereafter, she will be starting her move to the Flatiron District, which will be even better devoted and more permanently devoted to her collection. But go to the website. You can see images of her with some of the artists she's collected, including the late Tony Fayer, as well as installation shots and individual shots of some of the works from her collection, which I think you'll enjoy. And what else? We had an LA guest, David Prince, last episode, and we will have another LA guest next episode. So I wanted to break it up with little classic New York. And, you know, this is only the third collector we have had on this show and definitely passes the test for being a gracious guest. What else do I need to tell you? I guess we're about to head into sort of the final round of 2016 of openings. I believe there are a number of openings going on in Los Angeles this weekend, perhaps in New York and Chicago and Orlando and Santa Fe this weekend as well, I am imagining. Has there ever been an art form review of a show in Orlando? That's what I want to know. All right. We've got some bad advice, some great bad advice coming up for you on the back end, so please stay tuned for that. Thank you very much for being here. I appreciate it. And let's get to that conversation with Stacy Fabricant. I will talk to you on the back end. So where are you right now?
I'm in my apartment in Greenwich Village.
Okay, so this is the post-move or the pre-move? I can't remember.
Pre-move.
Got it. How's that going?
Pre-move. I moved once 2 years ago, and now I'm moving again, or I will be shortly.
Okay. How do you mind my asking why you're moving again?
I moved a couple of years ago when I was separating from my husband, and I rented a place for a couple of years, and now I found a place. And I promise you that once I move this art collection again, I'll never move again.
Right. So the place you've been in the last couple of years was kind of a transitional home situation.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun. It's a triplex apartment with, you know, skinny spiral stairs and stuff in between.
Mm-hmm.
And really high ceilings. It's been great for displaying art, but
right.
Time to move on to someplace a little quieter and a little more settled.
Yeah, and that's the Flatiron, if I remember right.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Got it. Is it quieter there for among other reasons because the Village is typically where weekend revelers go, kind of thing, or even round the clock all week? Would you say?
It's more my particular location.
Right.
My apartment now is located kind of right in the middle of the new school and NYU and all the stuff. So there's always a bunch of kids around, and
right.
There are a lot of kids in the building.
Ah.
So.
Got it.
You know, I guess I'm a little old for that.
I think anybody over about 26 is probably too old for that kind of scene, but you know.
I live on a busy street.
Right.
Like I have what I think of as a two-bedroom apartment here,
mm-hmm.
and the same one next door, I don't know how many kids they have living there, probably six or so.
Right.
It's just a little louder than you would like it to be.
Right. And I'm interested in your history with New York, because are you more or less born and bred in New York, or where are you from originally?
Born and raised in New York.
Mm-hmm.
I went to school out of town, but I've been back here since I was, I don't know, 24, so I guess I'm back 30 years.
And okay.
That's it. This is where you'll find me on my last days.
Right, right. How do you feel, though, as a lifelonger about, well, just improvise about the changes that you've noticed. And I'm just going to throw one prompt in before you do. And that is, I would imagine that over the course of the 30 years, that if you were to say there's one period that where things really changed dramatically, it would be over the last, like, 5-10 years. Is that more or less true?
I think it would probably look that way on paper, but as a lifelong resident, I'm not sure I would agree with that.
Okay.
When I was a kid, I grew up in the suburbs of New York, and I never thought I would want to live in the city and certainly not raise kids here and stuff, because, you know, in the 70s, and the city was creepy and scary and
right.
crime-ridden and stuff. And by the time I came back after school in the mid-80s, you know, as a kid, things were exciting and different. And I don't know, I suppose in a New York snob kind of way, I really feel like no place else really compares with New York in terms of pace and excitement and variety and diversity and culture and
mm-hmm.
and everything from restaurants to, you know, every block is different here. Every day is different here. And a lot of it's free, so it's easy to enjoy.
Sure.
For me, I think there have been a lot of landmarks in terms of a timeline on when New York changed a lot. Certainly 9/11 is the first thing that comes to mind.
Right.
You know, you see acts of war on TV all the time, but to see it with your own eyes in your own hometown was something
sure.
completely devastating.
Right. Well, I don't mean to take away from the weight of that event and New York City history, but I guess to be more specific, I'm kind of interested in more the quality of living, and you as a real estate attorney, right? You know, we'll be able to speak to this, I think, in a lot of different ways. But I'm interested in more the way that New York has changed in terms of cost of living, and you know, the people that, as much as that may still be true, that you each block is different, and there's all this variety and so on. You know, there are very few people that can move to Manhattan now, you know, and let alone, you know, certain areas of Brooklyn, too.
I think to a large extent that was always true. There were always these norms of in terms of income and expenses and stuff that were applicable for much of the rest of the country that never would have made it here.
Mm-hmm.
I think before 9/11, when Rudy Giuliani was mayor here, he instituted a lot of policies that cleaned up New York a lot and made the quality of living here better, and certainly the cost of living went up accordingly. And I think, you know, it's really prohibitively expensive now, and it's a worrisome thing to those of us that live here. You know, you want it to be a city for everybody and not just for rich people and stuff.
Right. That's basically what I was getting at.
But I think that has really always been something of the case, at least in Manhattan. And now I think it's spreading to the other boroughs as well.
Right. Well, I mean,
particularly Brooklyn.
But well, I mean, I used to live in Manhattan myself. So, I mean, I can tell you that, you know, I could afford to live in a few different places. I mean, there are definitely various funky places that you could be, and you know, whereas then, you know, you might be able to have your own place for a certain amount of money that you could afford. Now, to do that, that type of person would have to have, you know, 3-4 or more roommates, right, in some kind of very crammed situation. So I mean, that's kind of what I'm getting at as far as, and you said it yourself, the prohibitively expensive phase that where we are now. And I don't know. How does it, I mean, you did say that that feels kind of ominous, I guess. So how does it feel ominous?
Well, I know, for example, that as an artist, it's very hard to not only find a place you can afford rent here, but then to rent a studio as well.
Right.
Is really daunting.
Yeah.
But having said that, I do feel that for the most part, I don't know, the really dedicated find a way. You know, I know plenty of artists that have never been able to give up their day jobs for one reason or another.
Right.
But they still have studio space. They still find places to store their stuff, and they still find a place to live.
Right.
I'm not saying it's easy or inexpensive. That's certainly not the case.
Right.
But there's always seems to be a way if you really want to get it done.
Mm-hmm. So who are these artists that you're referring to? Are these primarily artists that whose work you own, would you say?
Not necessarily own. You know, if I could, I'd buy something new every day, and
right.
I'm not really in a position to do that.
Right.
But many that I own, many that I know, or meeting galleries, I do a lot of legal work for galleries and for artists as well, and find myself having to, I have, you know, startup rates, I have not-for-profit rates, I have barter rates, I have all kinds of rates to try to make it easy for people, particularly when they really need the help.
Have you acquired some works through barter rates?
I have quite a few thank you gifts on my walls.
I'm
proud to say, actually. When I was still married, I was able to afford to work pro bono all the time. So I did all the legal work for free. And now I kind of need to make some money of my own, but I still help out when I can. And yeah, I still do some bartering if that's what suits the situation.
So when you were pro bono, were you, you know, really incredibly sought after because of that kind of level of generosity?
I think so. I mean, I started out doing it just for not-for-profit arts organizations, but, you know, you meet somebody in that context and they're on the board of another charity that might be a woman's shelter or some other organization. And so, yeah, you get called in on some other things. And frankly, it feels really good to get a really nice thank you or a round of applause at the board meeting or something instead of a paycheck.
Right.
It's not easy to eat that way, but it does feel nice.
Can you give me a typical case that you were involved with an artist, you know, that you were a case you were working on with them, since you mentioned that happened a number of times?
Well, just bear in mind, I maintain the confidentiality required.
Sure, I will.
But there have been, generally speaking, situations where, to go back to your last point, there are a number of situations at any given time here in New York where a developer is trying to buy out a rent-stabilized tenant or an otherwise protected tenant in a building so that they can put up a new condo building or something like that.
Right.
And I have been able, on occasion, when asked, to represent people who actually got quite a nice buyout, which enabled, unfortunately, you know, one more building to go down to a developer, but at the
right.
same time, you know, may have afforded an artist a chance to buy something of their own, you know, have equity in the situation, not have to be subject to the whims of a landlord in terms of the length of the lease and stuff like that. So that's been very gratifying. And other situations where, I don't know, there were disputes over payments and, you know,
right.
typical stuff that comes up in every commercial context. But my contacts were largely in the field of, you know, emerging artist galleries and their artists. And so that's where the word got around, and that's where I wound up doing a lot of work.
Mm-hmm. Can we stay on that for a little bit more as far as without, you know, obviously maintaining confidentiality, but I'm interested in, because I've talked with people on the show before about artists and galleries and artists maybe not demanding or expecting a certain amount of autonomy and control in their contracts and so on. So I guess I'd love to hear some of your takeaways from emerging artist and dealer situations that you've been involved with?
I think that each situation really needs to be evaluated on its particular merits and circumstances. I think a lot of times artists need an extra level of protection or maybe education before they get into some of these agreements.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was long the case that an artist never went after a gallery if they weren't paid.
Mm-hmm.
But I do know that word goes out, I mean, as a collector myself, I know word goes out that a gallery may not be paying its artists properly, mm-hmm. and that people tend to shy away from them.
Right.
On the, you know, a feeling that they're protecting the artist somehow. I suppose it's a shame that the artist isn't going to sell there, but I think there is a consensus among collectors, or at least those that I know, that, you know, we really don't support the galleries that have those kinds of reputations if we don't have to.
Right, right. Would you say that, because my sense is that if an artist is given a contract that they're going to read it to whatever extent that they have the patience to read through all the, you know, the language. And because they're I'm going to presume that generally, especially if they're particularly young and or emerging, that they're going to be so motivated, you know, to be part of that team that they're just going to go ahead and sign it. Would you say that, I imagine that the ideal situation for an artist in, you know, getting a contract from their dealer would be that they could show it to an attorney and have them make notes on it or suggestions or what have you. So my question would be, you know, how often is that actually possible? I mean, how much would you do something like that pro bono? Or if not, you know, how much would you or one of your colleagues charge to review a contract? And if that's not possible for the artist to do, what would you suggest that they do, you know, if they want to vet
the
contract?
Okay, so I think the ideal situation would be, of course, an artist or anybody for that matter would have legal representation and advice before signing a contract, and in fact have equal negotiating posture so that one attorney and another could discuss the terms of the agreement and make it work out for everybody. I don't think that's ever been the case. I don't mm-hmm. since I've been doing this.
Mm-hmm.
And the second point I'd like to make, I guess, is that I'm glad my number's unlisted since you're volunteering my pro bono services to artists in this regard. But what I find often is that the attorney does not have equal bargaining power. And in many cases, there's so much competition for whatever slot the artist is trying to fit into, be it with a lease or a gallery contract or otherwise, that a lot of times the person with the superior bargaining power says, ah, I don't need to spend money on a lawyer negotiating this, either sign it or else. And if they don't sign it, they've got somebody else in the pipeline who will.
Right.
Right. What I find myself doing most of the time is reviewing the contract just with the artist and saying, you know, these are really the high points I want you to understand the consequences of. This is what it means to have the right to sublet or assign a space if you're taking a studio space. This is what it means in terms of when the payments happen, in terms of negotiating a contract with a gallery. I just want them to understand the details. If there are a couple of things they can't live with, then they can go back and talk to the principal on the other side and say, look, this is the thing that really bothers me, and hopefully they work it out.
Mm-hmm.
But at least I get them a good understanding of what it is they're getting into so that there aren't any big surprises on the other end.
Right. Yeah. Like you say, we should probably imagine for a moment the typical scenario, which is that the artist is going to be like, I'm not going to be difficult because I don't want to lose this opportunity. Right. So they just sign it.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, how many times out of 10 are they going to be on the short end of getting screwed, I guess, you know?
I think I'm happy to say that with the galleries that I know well in New York, I really think most of them view their artists as as being on the same team and sitting on the same side of the table that they're in. I think right. they view it as what's best for them is best for the artist and vice versa. I think there are details here and there that get hashed out over time, but for the most part, the more successful the artist, the happier the gallery is, and vice versa. Obviously, that's not the rule in every case, but I do know quite a few galleries pretty well here, and I think they're all very conscientious and fair
mm-hmm.
people to deal with. Obviously, as an attorney, I see the dark side as well. But at least on that end of the deal, I think most of it is pretty fair. I think when an artist is looking for a studio space, there's a lot less negotiating power on the part of the artist. For example, they might be one of 100 tenants in a studio building as opposed to one of 20 artists on a roster for a gallery.
Mm-hmm.
And if they're one of 100 or one of 500, I don't know, they may invest, for example, a lot of time and money in fixing up the studio how they want to, and then they have no right to renew the lease and they lose all that investment.
Right.
So I think it's easier for people to not necessarily go into it to take advantage of an artist, but to be more dismissive of an artist's concerns and to be in it just for the buck.
Yeah.
As opposed to many of the galleries I work with that have a longer term view and have a vested interest in the artists themselves. A landlord doesn't have that kind of concern.
Right. And speaking of studios in New York, in Manhattan, my perception is that they're virtually the only ones left are the really big studios. You know, that all of the like shared studio, group studio situations are in the other boroughs.
I disagree. I actually represent a number of artists who have rented spaces where they can afford a decent space as long as there's some supplement to the rent, and they take a little bit more space than they need and rent out a couple of places to other artists, and they hope to either grow into the rest of the space later or, you mm-hmm. know, keep it going where they've been able to set something up that works for a small group.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard of any number of situations of people where they get together in groups and they divvy up the space, they divvy up the time, they mm-hmm. Divide it up any different way that sort of works for everybody. They're able that way to share equipment or get contributions towards equipment and stuff. And I still have been doing these leases downtown, mm-hmm. you know, south of Canal Street here. There's mm-hmm. still a lot that's available, and they've been making it happen.
Can we be specific about rent? Like, what kind of rent are we talking about, per square foot or for
well,
the whole thing?
Well, it's generally on a square foot basis, and generally, you know, how much pain are you willing to bear? If you're willing to go climb up to the third floor in a walk-up,
mm-hmm.
there's still plenty of stuff available.
Mm-hmm.
And there are still landlords that will even do the work to make the place habitable and stuff like that.
Right.
So it's still out there.
But you didn't answer the question about what kind of rent we're talking about.
I've seen everything from a couple of $1,000 a month for three people to share to mm-hmm. upwards of $20,000 a month. It, you know, it really depends on the size, the location, the amenities,
sure.
the perks in the building and the neighborhood.
A couple of $1,000 a month, how much space will that get you? And from the situation you saw?
Well, in the boroughs, I would say it starts at $12 to $15 a square foot per annum. And Manhattan, you know, you can still find stuff in low 20s a square foot, you know, assuming you're willing to work for it.
I'm sorry, $20 a square foot per annum? What does that mean? Isn't that just $20 a square foot?
Yes, but as a broker and an attorney, we think of the rent on a per annum basis. As a tenant and an artist, you'll probably think of it as a monthly fee. So
mm-hmm.
I say per annum just to draw that distinction.
Okay, so let's just say it's $10 a square foot, and it's
and let's say it's 1,000 square feet.
Right.
Okay, we'll make the math easy.
Yeah.
So for $10,000 a year, you can have a studio.
Oh, okay. $10,000. So I see. So
but I'm saying really, yeah. It starts really at twice that in the city,
right.
In Manhattan,
right.
and goes up from there.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So like around a little over $2,000 a month, basically.
Right.
And that would get you 1,000 square feet.
Right. And you could have, you know, depending on your situation, you could have 2, 3, 4 artists in a space like
right.
that would really have a sort of luxurious space to share. There could
yeah.
be a pantry. There could be some machinery or equipment that you use for certain kinds of practice. You could, you know, just have great big wide open rooms. You could have a view of the river. You could have anything.
Right. Well, I'm just, you know, I hear your disagreement, and I'm not going to disagree with you as far as your experience, because you obviously have it. You're doing it in your work with all these people. But just anecdotally, from my experience, because I talked to a woman artist who is she lives and works in a loft or large apartment in Harlem. And I spoke to her, I think this is about 3.5 years ago, let's say. Maybe even 4. And even then, my sense was, wow, you're like one of the last artists working in Manhattan. You know what I mean? And that's not literally true, as you can well bear out from all the work that you do. But just anecdotally, from all of the people, I just put out my 162nd episode, you know, and a lot of the episodes I've done are with New York people, New York artists, New York writers, curators, etc. And just, you know, I've spoken to so few people who are in Manhattan, and the last artist that I spoke to who lives in Manhattan, she lives on like 14th Street in a studio apartment, 14th and 7th. But her studio is in Greenpoint. You know what I mean? So it's like, where all the artists, you know, in the communities, I should say, that I've been encountering, you know, they're all working in studios outside of Manhattan. And so, you know, maybe there's this alternate universe.
Easier,
yeah, go ahead.
I do think it's easier to put things together like this in the outer boroughs.
Yeah.
Harlem, I think, was one of the later places to come into this game.
Mm-hmm.
Although I do know there are some sort of, I guess you'd call them studio communities, that are growing up, particularly in East Harlem, that are really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I think the little bit scary part about Brooklyn is that it seems the artists go to the next neighborhood and the developers are right on their heels, and so they only get a couple of years in a studio before they're forced to move again,
right.
You know, deeper, further, whatever.
Yeah.
I'm hoping that'll come to a stop in Brooklyn when there's some subway work and stuff going on that's going to mess up the commute for a lot of people. And I'm hoping that sort of gives artists a chance to settle a little bit and get to stay where they are for a while.
Mm-hmm.
But I think in New York seems to be, anyway, you know, there's always another rock to overturn. There's always another corner to climb into. There's always another place that hasn't yet been discovered and sort of overdeveloped before an artist can get in there and make use of it.
Right. As you're saying that, I'm really interested in exploring your dynamic with the art world as a collector, not only as a collector, but as we've been talking about, somebody who's been working with artists, you know, for contracts and whatnot. So I don't know. I don't know exactly where to start, but I guess my first question is, do you feel like you've gotten acquainted with artists / the New York art world through your work, or did you start kind of earlier on, you know, going to galleries and whatnot and buying things from galleries, or both?
Well, my mom collected art when I was a kid, and that was in the 70s, and frankly, I never thought I would collect art because everything my mother had was kind of embarrassing, and there were flying naked pieces of people all over the house, and you know, it was very embarrassing as a kid. But you know, you come to New York and you get your first grown-up apartment and you buy a painting for over the couch, and then maybe another one and another one, and then I sort of retired about 10 years ago, and I found myself in Chelsea 3 or 4 days a week, and
wow,
I guess I'm a junkie. I mean, I just,
yeah,
you know, that's what makes me happy, is to walk into a space that's filled with great art, and I just get elated.
Right.
Can't explain it.
But, when can we go back to your mom,
so,
your mother, for a second?
Yeah,
sure. Because I just want to give people maybe a visual cue, because you told me a little bit about, you referred to her a little bit when we spoke earlier, and what I pictured, for lack of a better example, is, I don't know if you remember from the movie A Clockwork Orange, there's that, the sort of yoga or, you know, sort of fitness lady, you know, the home that they go into, and she's got all this sort of early 70s, late 60s kind of nude, sort of loud and kind of body art on the walls and sculptures.
Well, it may be a few decades too many since I've seen A Clockwork Orange.
Right.
But you walked into our front door and there was a David Sally drawing of a naked man from the back, and that went on to a piece from Robert Morris, where there were literally flying testicles sort of built all into, can I say this in your podcast?
Yes, you can say anything.
That were sort of flying all over the piece. And
mm-hmm.
and when I was little, there was this mushroom form that turned out not to be mushrooms. And I didn't really know when I was little, but the holes in the top of the mushrooms meant they weren't actually mushrooms. Do you know what I'm saying?
Hmm. It meant that that it was a fabrication of a mushroom?
No, it was a fabrication of the head of a penis, but it was,
oh.
I thought it was a mushroom when
no,
I was little.
No, obviously I didn't know what you meant.
And I saw there were holes in the top.
Got it. So you thought all these mushrooms.
This was pretty racy stuff, or
right.
pretty controversial stuff for
right.
like a nice suburban household back then.
Right.
So it was always embarrassing to have friends over, and they'd tease us about it and whatever, and I never thought I'd get into collecting, but when I found myself with a lot of time on my hands, I couldn't stay away from it.
Wow.
So,
well, take us back to, you mentioned the, you know, you become a grown up, which I think, of course, is a funny cliche that you become a grown up and then you buy art for your behind the couch. But in any case, take us back to that phase, because on one hand, you know, maybe you were like a novel. On the other, you had, you know, these built-in either genes or, you know, just literal experience from having grown up with contemporary art that was guiding you in some way. So do you think you had good instincts? And do you remember what, like, the first behind the couch piece was?
Oh, I absolutely remember the first things I bought. And I love them to this day. So,
uh-huh.
But I do wonder if you took everything I've acquired over the last 25 years or so that I've been collecting and put it in chronological order, I wonder if it would depict, you know, my growing wisdom and maturity or insanity
mm-hmm.
or
mm-hmm.
living in New York too long or something. I'm sure it would be interesting from a psychological standpoint.
Right.
But the first things I bought were pretty... I don't want to say minimalist, but they were fairly contained. And I think as the years have passed, I've gotten more eclectic in what I've been interested in.
What were the first things? Can you mention a few names?
Yeah, the first things that I bought were some Sugimoto photographs,
mm-hmm,
the seascapes that he's done.
Uh-huh.
So they were pretty, I don't want to call them simple, but pretty minimalist.
They sound very tasteful.
And an Alan McCollum, this set of surrogates, which were, they were colored plaster pieces in the shape of a frame, a mat, and a picture, but there was no picture there. It was
right.
So there was no there, if you will. And I think that probably went back to the fact that I was really into art but didn't want to depict the same things my mother had when I was young.
Right, right. That's interesting.
And now I still like the stuff I bought 20 years ago. I still love the stuff I bought yesterday. If I could, I'd bring home something great every day. But
right.
I can't. And I think if I could have, I would have been one of those really nice people that really supports an artist's careers in a lot of material, financial ways. And I couldn't ever really do that.
Mm.
So
mm-hmm.
I mean, I made a decent living, but not enough to, you know, I mean, I have my own museum, just come over, but I'm not right. like in the sense of some of these other people.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
So instead, like when my big kids grew up and left the house, like I always had extra bedrooms and stuff. And I knew a lot of artists that came in from New Haven and other places. And so they always had a place to stay when they came to New York. And I got to know some of them that way.
Mm-hmm.
And even though I had to give up my big place and stuff, you know, now my youngest is in college, so there's always an extra bedroom if you're coming into town.
So you like to hang out? You like to hang out with artists as well as collect them. You don't just, right?
Well, I don't want to sound like a creepy old lady. No,
that's not what I was getting. That's not what I was getting at.
Sometimes we've hit it off. Mm-hmm. You know, some of them I'm really close to. One or two that I've never been able to either afford or didn't have a house big enough to fit the stuff, maybe. Mm-hmm, but, mm-hmm. you know, a few. I think there are a bunch of really great artists up in New Haven, for example, that after Yale were never able to move back down here because of the cost.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been trying to help them make New Haven more of an art destination, and I put them up when they come here to New York if they mm-hmm. don't have a place to stay. Mm-hmm. So it's been that sort of thing. I think because I'm really into the emerging art, and also because the price point was more easily approachable for me, that's how I got in with the younger, newer galleries that might have needed, you know, either a little more help or a little more education or a little cheaper rate or something like that. And
right.
so that's how I think I got into that niche.
Here's a big question for you to contemplate.
Mm-hmm.
What has been your experience with your relationship with the work that you've bought and collected and the artists that make it, as far as kind of expectations, like this work I really love, this artist I really love? You know, that's just obviously the most simplistic comparison, but do you find that there's been any kind of indication from your relation or your feelings about work that somehow, you know, can be transposed or can be also seen in your feelings about the person, or is it total much more arbitrary for the most part?
I'm not totally sure what you're talking about, but I think I could explain by saying there's one artist I became very close to, and he was probably showing in the wrong place for a long time. But I kept collecting the work. I still thought he was terrific. We've actually become really close friends with his family and my family and stuff. And now he's really making a great name for himself and really doing well. And I don't think it's because I liked him so much or because I have such a great eye. I just think he finally wound up in the place where he's supposed to be, and I think he really is a great artist.
Right.
I think collectors have mixed feelings. You know, well, I have one artist where I probably have 10 or 15 pieces by the same guy. He tanked his career. What can I tell you? He did. I think a lot of artists get a lot of collectors get resentful about that sort of thing. But I think artists are a breed apart for a lot of reasons, and they don't always play by the rules. I think also, for example, there was this flavor of the month feeling for the last few years where you
sure.
could buy an artist at $4,000 and somehow 6 weeks later they were selling for 20 times as much. And
right.
then sometimes they crashed and burned afterwards. I haven't really had that experience. I'm not in it for the flips. So
good for you.
I can't really speak to that. But I think a lot of collectors have been quite annoyed by the rise and fall of some of the
sure.
younger artists and stuff. I think that I know there's a lot of talk about art being a commodity, and I suppose if I could afford seven-figure art, I'd feel that way too. But I think I buy what I love.
Mm-hmm.
And love to live with it.
And
I think that's what you have to really get in it for.
Sure. Yeah, of course. Who is the artist that you have 10 pieces of whose career tanked?
I'm not fair, sure that's fair to say now that I've described his career.
Okay,
way.
I didn't think you would, but I thought I would ask.
I still believe is a great artist, and right. I hope always will be.
Yeah.
Well, you know, sometimes for free I represent these groups where it's a collective or a co-op where they put together some equipment and maybe some classes, and this way artists who are never able to quit their day jobs have a place to go. They're still artists.
Yeah.
Whether or not they sell or become famous is something else. But they're still artists, and it's who they are all the way through, and you have to respect that.
Have you ever bought an artist outside of a gallery?
Have I ever bought an artist outside of a gallery?
Yeah, because you just described...
I have bought things at auction on occasion where I felt like I was sort of sneaking in with nobody looking. And there have been artists where I couldn't necessarily get as much or afford as much as I wanted, where I was able to get something at auction. Have I ever bought something
anywhere
else?
Well, let me give you an example. I mean, because you describe being supportive of the New Haven scene, you know, the post-Yale scene or what have you, but maybe you have an artist that you've collected up there, you know, through galleries or what have you, and then you meet their friend who isn't showing yet, or they're still in school?
I have not done that yet, and I am very respectful of the gallery's place in all this. I'm trying to think if I ever bought something directly from an artist. Not really, because, I mean, like I said, I have gotten sort of, you know, bartered things or thank you gifts here and there.
Right.
Right. I think I did buy something once or twice from an artist who kind of, you know, needed the money and didn't have any representation at the time. But I'm not into, I don't do a backroom deal or anything like that. I don't.
That's not what I was, getting at more people who are just not in the market, you know, who aren't represented, because, you know, there's only a finite amount of space in the galleries, as many as there are. And so there could be artists whose work you might like that aren't represented by those galleries. That's all I was getting at.
I have not really been lucky enough to catch an artist that early on that there was no gallery involved.
Right.
I have, I have gone to shows of master's theses. I have, I remember one time I went up to the Studio Museum where they have an artist in residency program for three artists at a time, and fell in love with all three artists at once, and actually wound up collecting all three of them, but they all had studio representation from the inception.
Right. Okay. Well, I mean, I'm
not that early enough on the scene.
Well, I'm not. Yeah, but I'm not buying that model, because what the model you're describing is one in which the galleries are all knowing and they will find the artists that the collectors will buy, you know, and that the artists that do not make it into that system or that cycle, you know, are not to be valued, basically. So I'm just talking about that kind of alternative universe. It's not a question of getting them early enough. It's a question of getting them when they're not being represented by one of the, you know, well-traveled collector-cycled galleries.
For me, it's usually a question of finding an artist, and oftentimes outside of a gallery context, but then finding that they're already represented.
Right.
And maybe not even by a gallery in New York, but, you know, they already have representation, and so you wind up going through them anyway.
Right. Can we go back to, you mentioned that phase, I don't know if it was like 10 years ago or whatever, that you found yourself in Chelsea like 3 days a week. So
yeah.
Was that so that you could cover all the galleries, and you found yourself not only doing that, but you would spend quite a lot of time, maybe because you would be speaking with a number of people, you know, at the galleries along the way, or, you know, that you just loved to be there? Was it, what did that look like specifically?
Well, it was kind of all of the above. I mean, I'm not, and I'm sure I should be, but I'm not really much for the social aspect of the whole art collection thing. I really only go to an opening if I did the lease for the gallery.
Right.
Or it's an artist that I know.
Okay.
I'm not really into you know, I don't know. I just can't deal with that whole thing. But I did like, you know, I hadn't been an art history major. I had never had any formal education in that regard at all. Mm-hmm. And I really found I learned a lot the more I went around and talked to people, and maybe I would see a show and then I would come back and see it again and have a different take on it. And so, yeah, if you could meet with somebody at the gallery, especially the artist, but if you could meet with somebody at the gallery who really knew what the show was about, I really found myself learning a lot.
Right.
I guess I'm like a self-taught person in that way. But that was really the draw for me, was to like, I mean, I had been used to working for 25 years and didn't know what to do all day, and all of a sudden I found myself really enthralled with something.
Right.
So what I loved when the gallery started moving to the Lower East Side was that it seemed much more approachable. Like, you could always find the owner of the gallery there, mm-hmm. and half the time the artist was around, even if it wasn't the opening day and stuff.
Right.
So I've loved the sort of more relaxed atmosphere down there as the galleries have moved down there and stuff.
Got it.
And so I think now I only take a tour around the galleries maybe once a week because, you know, it's I can get my head around it now, even though there are even more artists and even more galleries. I can get my head around it now and have something of a background to jump off from.
Well, do you, when you do that one day a week, do you sort of plan out what your itinerary is going to be ahead of time, or do you just hit a neighborhood and just kind of cover most of it?
I generally hit a neighborhood and you know, do a scorched earth thing in terms of seeing every show there.
Right.
But there are, occasionally there are some things that I just can't wait to get to see, and so I'll start out at one place certain and then take it from there.
And what has been your experience as far as, you know, that the galleries know you as a collector, and so, you know, each one is going to have sort of their own approach, whether it's, you know, they treat you as they treat most other people coming to the gallery, or they're, you know, they give you the hard sell, or, you know, maybe something more like they want to show you, you know, some pieces that didn't make it into the show in the back, you know, in the shows in the back, or what has been that experience from your memory?
I don't find too much of a hard sell when I'm there in person.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they all send out these emails with JPEGs and, you know, this is totally for you, Stace, you got to come down and get one right away. But when you're there in person, I really find most of them love the work in the same way that I do, or even if it's work I'm not crazy about, they're at least very anxious to share, you know, what it's about, where it comes from. Maybe that's because I'm into some conceptual stuff. Maybe that's because a lot of the artists that I can afford anyway are still on the younger side and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But I find they have a genuine enthusiasm for the work, and sometimes it's infectious if the work speaks to you, and sometimes it leaves you cold. But, you know, it's always something new and different, and I'm always eager to learn.
Yeah, and I would imagine from the little that I know of you so far that with work that people are, the gallerists are showing you that it leaves you cold, that you're going to be diplomatic in your response, you know, because, and I'll just set this up a little bit further by saying that I imagine, and I know this is a projection to some degree, but that there are some collectors that are just very overly honest maybe about their feelings. Like if they see something that they really don't like, they're just going to say, I'm not interested in that. You know what I mean? They're just going to be very blunt about it.
Well, for me, I think it's a little easier for me to say without being offensive because,
right.
Just for example, I don't really have any figurative art. Some of it's beautiful and gorgeous, but there's no portraits in my home. There's no pictures of pretty flowers. And
good for you.
So most of the artists that know me even a little bit know that. And so it's very easy for me to say, God, that's really beautiful. It's just not for me.
Sure.
But also because I was trying to drum up a little business as an attorney, I've had a few get-togethers at my home. So anybody that didn't understand too much about my collection, they know it now. And anybody that knows me knows that in laying out my new apartment, I really don't care about the furniture. I'm just rearranging and recurating my own collection. So
wow.
That's all I care
right.
about. I'm measuring the wall space, not the floor space.
Do you have a way other than what, in addition, I should say, to what you just described, you know, that you don't have portraits and pictures of flowers and stuff like that, do you have a way that you like to sort of give a spiel of your collection? I mean, I there's some collectors that, you know, especially ones like that are either already have museums or, you know, or maybe have the ambition to have them that have these, or even ones who don't, that have this sort of shtick about the way they describe their collection as if they're curators, you know, when, which seems kind of counterintuitive because it seems like as a collector, you can kind of collect a variety of anything that you want. But do you have a way that you like to, or do you, is it a little more miscellaneous?
It's a little more miscellaneous, but if you're here, mm-hmm. And if you're in New York, stop by.
I will,
but believe
me.
If you're here,
yeah.
I love to see the things that people are drawn to in my
right.
collection, and I'll start with that. Because a lot of them have a backstory that isn't readily apparent that makes the piece so much more intense or interesting or compelling to some people, or some of it's a total turnoff.
Right.
But I'm hard-pressed to describe my collection in a general sense, but if
sure.
you're here and I see where your eyes go, I can point out the stuff that makes me laugh or point out the
right.
stuff that makes me think or point out the stuff that makes me happy.
Right.
And it's been interesting to see friends of mine over the years who never got, you know, they walk in and they think, oh, my kid could do that, or, you know, comments like that for people that really aren't into things, but that over the years they've developed their own favorite pieces in my collection, or they found a newfound appreciation for something that they may have laughed at the beginning.
Wow, that's great.
So that's really cool. I love to have people here. I love to show off my stuff. I love my stuff. I think it's
right.
the greatest. And so they're not necessarily famous artists.
Right.
They're not necessarily the hottest selling artists. I hope one day they will be for their sake as well as mine.
Mm-hmm.
But I really just like to see, you know, there's some text-based work. There's some stuff that you don't really get it until you really look at what the picture is. Or there's some stuff that looks like one thing but is totally something else. And I think a lot of that is what makes it continue to be interesting to me, and what's interesting to show to people seeing it for the first or the 10th or the 50th time.
Right. Is there work in your collection that has consistently elicited the strongest reactions, either on the positive and or negative side?
Yeah, I think so. I think the best, the best example I can probably give you is
mm-hmm.
I think I mentioned before, I don't mean to dwell on this, but I think I mentioned before I was married for 10 years to this guy, and every time I brought something new home, he thought it was the most ridiculous waste of money he ever saw in his lifetime. And now that we're divorced, he has 22 pieces of mine in his apartment because he just didn't like the way the place looked without contemporary art in it anymore.
Wow.
And he's flying out to San Francisco or someplace to go to an opening, and he's bought a couple of pieces of his own, and he follows my artists, and he can't wait to see the Agnes Martin show at the Whitney or at the Met. And like all of a sudden, this man who's obsessed with antiques and ridiculed my art collecting all those years now can't seem to live happily in a home without it. So, ha ha ha.
Right. Was it tricky in your divorce separating the art, or was it all yours essentially?
No, it was all mine. He never right. supported a dollar. You know,
right.
he never donated a dollar to the collection.
Right.
So,
okay.
But this man, you know, he's almost a hoarder. I mean, it's first class antiques, but it's still
yeah.
this obsessive collecting. And all of a sudden, he bought a couple of pieces of his own at the Armory show, and now he's going to an opening on the West Coast. I mean,
yeah.
go figure.
Go figure. Well, what? But getting back to your collection, I'm kind of, is there not a one or two pieces maybe of art that you can name specifically that have elicited strong reactions aside from your husband's dismissals?
Yeah, there are a couple. I have one piece in particular by a West Coast artist named Zyler Jean. Not sure if anybody's ever heard of her.
I have
she's
heard
fantastic.
Of her.
Fantastic.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
Have you?
Yes.
She's wonderful. And I'm telling you, I have not only the best piece she ever did, but it's just this glorious thing. So little kids come in and say, oh, my gosh, that's a spider web. And high school kids came in and said, oh my gosh, that's a black hole in space. And grown-ups came in and said, oh, that's just a black and white mishmash. What is that?
Right.
But it's not black and white. It's dark, 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 dark brown, blue, green, purple. Yeah, but anything but black. And if you turn the piece over, you see that it's a calendar of a 25-year period in her life, and that each meticulously done brushstroke represents a different day during this period. And so it's a whole different kind of thing from what it first appears to be. And for some reason, that never fails to, you know, bring up comments from whoever's coming to the house, especially for the first time.
Right. Did you ever meet her?
Yes, I have. I have. She's wonderful.
Okay, good. Well, that's good. I'm glad we have a specific example to think about. Yeah, I will definitely take you up on that offer to look at your collection. I would be interested to,
That would be fun. That would be really
absolutely,
fun.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You know, I found myself like being a little careful in terms of profanity or nudity when my kid was little, and my daughter grew up to be quite an activist, and I find myself, you know, leaning a little more political sometimes. In some of the things I've collected more recently. That may also be because of the times themselves.
Right.
You know, it's interesting to see, again, if I group them chronologically, like where I was at different points in my life and where that led me in terms of collecting.
Can you give me maybe the last couple of pieces that you bought? Where and who?
The last couple of pieces I bought were one from an artist named Tavares Striken.
Okay.
He's a terrific artist here in New York who does, I don't know how to describe his practice, but I have a neon of his, I have a collage of his, and I have a sculpture of his.
Wow, okay.
So there are not too many artists I collect in depth, but he's one that I do and hope to do more of.
And where did you get him, his work?
He does not have representation. He works with a representative and no gallery.
Huh.
He
so is that like
a
consultant
setup.
Or a representative just for him?
The representative works with a few different artists, but sort of like David Hammond's never really worked with a gallery.
Right, right.
You know, so it's kind of that sort of situation.
Interesting, yeah.
And he's somebody whose work I think is tremendous. Again, may not be famous, but works for me.
That's fine. Yeah.
And he was the first to come to mind in terms of the most recent sort of more political works that I've been into lately.
Got it.
Brie Roué is a ceramicist who I bought a piece from recently who I never would have thought I'd ever be interested in ceramics, but I'm looking at this great, brilliant, victorious thing on the wall, and it just makes me happy every time I look at it.
Wow.
So,
that's great. So here's
those are some of the more
recent ones. Okay, thank you for the examples. Here's a question for you. What is your history with the art fairs? Do you go, I imagine you go local, but do you go to Miami at all or anywhere else?
No.
Okay.
No.
Good for you.
No. My history with the art fairs is I tend to get a little caught up, especially like a bunch of years ago when everything was so frantic and they were like, well, you have to tell me if you want it now because in 11 seconds I'll sell it to somebody else. You know, I tend to get a little too caught up in that. So I'm very cautious now at art fairs.
Right.
And I love them. I feel like I'm just, you know, in this big art universe where I could just hang out and be happy for a few days. But I have to say, at least where I'm living now, if you come over, I'm living in an art universe here too. Like my walls are wallpapered with with art. I'm not sure everybody could live happily here, but I sure do.
Right, right. And what? How much planning have you been putting into the layout of your new home as far as where the art's going to go?
Well, I bought the place with the big walls and the high ceilings.
Okay.
I really don't care about a view or the light because it's bad for paintings anyway.
Okay.
I'm not looking out the window. I'm looking inside.
Right.
And my biggest concern right now is, like, I have a general idea of what I want to do in the living space, but in my bedroom there's one wall that sort of smacks you in the face right when you walk in the room, and I just can't decide what to put there. Like, what do I want to see the first thing when I walk in my room every day? And that's the most exciting thing for me. That and figuring out which pieces are safe to hang in the bathroom, because sometimes you just need every wall you can get.
Right, right. You know, I could have brought this up at the beginning, but maybe it's a good sort of place to wind down, and that is that if one is to do a search of you, you have a pretty good, you've been pretty good about minimizing news about yourself. Let's put it that way. I don't know if that was by design.
Well, I'm not a big fancy rich collector. I'm really not. I'm just a kid, just a person.
I see.
I mean, I'm not a, you know.
Right. But I think even by not by collector standards, just by sort of anybody's standards, there's not much out there on you. And I guess I don't know if you've thought about that one way or another, but the stuff that there is sort of related to your name, and which I guess is your family, your ancestry,
right.
and then, you know, some of the work situations you've been involved with as a real estate attorney, basically. But do you want to maybe say just a line or two about Fabricant? Or not. You don't have to.
Well, my family's probably best known for being in the wholesale jewelry business here in the city for many, many years.
Mm-hmm.
And I really like my family, so I never went into that business, although I do help them here and there with leases and things like that.
Right.
What
kind of jewelry is it?
Well, everybody in my family is in a different aspect of the business, but for the most part, like, my brother's the guy that...
I think we're
so
close.
I will
we should
say
be...
that I have
okay, go ahead.
Personally traded in some old jewelry from the 80s and bought paintings with the money instead.
Oh, okay.
So that's been fun.
Right.
And they still, in my family, they can't really understand why I'd rather have a painting than a diamond pair of some things, but,
right.
You know,
yeah,
I would rather have the painting.
Yeah, me too. I guess I was curious if the when I was asking what kind of jewelry, if they have been located kind of in the Diamond District, or if it's like a whole other part
of
town.
They've been on 47th Street.
Oh, okay, so they are part of the right. Is any
of so when you're in New York, come see the collection,
right.
And if you're getting engaged, we'll take care of that too.
No, but is any of
anything you need? We're a multi-service family.
Is any of your family Orthodox?
No.
Okay.
No.
That's just a cliche about some of the industry,
right? Oh yeah.
Right?
No.
Okay.
No.
Okay.
That, yeah. No.
All right. You're a secular person, I take it.
I really like the twice a year type celebrations of
right.
You know, there's a family dinner in the fall and a family dinner in the spring, and that's pretty much it for me.
I see. Yeah, that sounds healthy. Good.
And if I don't have to cook, so much the better.
Right. Right. Well, Stacey, this has been a lot of fun. Apologies for the phone cutoffs, but is there anything?
Oh, no worries.
Is there anything you feel remiss that we didn't sort of say towards the end here, or do you think we've gotten to it?
No, I guess I'm just surprised that you would think that my name might be more Googleable or whatever. I mean, in a small apartment, I think in New York most people have. I mean, there's just so many big collectors here. I'm just not even on the radar.
No, I just...
Certainly not with...
Right. It wasn't that I thought, oh, she's a collector, she's going to be all over the place. It's just that when you do a search of your name, there's just not very much that comes up at all, and you have an unusual name. So that was just... So that's kind of keeping under the radar in a good way.
When you're in the jewelry business to keep your name...
Right.
Out of the paper, because people think you have diamonds on you all the time and stuff. So
right.
I guess that was learned early on. But otherwise, I mean, there's just so many big people here. Like, you know, I'm just a too little a fish.
Do you feel any envy towards any of them, or do you compare yourself, or how what's that like, that dynamic?
Well, I think if I had unlimited funds, I would buy myself a football stadium, and then I would put in that huge thing, like, you know, with the dry cleaner, when you punch in number 1312 and it wrecks around, and then you
right.
come up with that one piece?
Right.
And then I could look at all my thousands of pieces of art all day long. But short of that, I think I'm pretty happy with where I am, because I really don't believe in storage. I think all those fancy people with their big collections, I think once you put art in a box and put the box in the closet, it's not art anymore. And
right.
I'm not sure that as a collector I have the right to do that.
Yeah.
So,
well, I think that's...
And I really like looking at my stuff.
Yeah.
I didn't buy it for investment or
right.
for showing off. I really like it. So I think I'm pretty okay with where I am.
Yeah.
But
I think,
again, you know,
mm-hmm.
barter, whatever.
Right.
I'm always in the game for that.
Yeah, no, I think that's fantastic. I mean, that's like you make a model collector by being in love with the stuff that you have and living with it and, you know, and seeing it all the time. And I think you're right. You know, there's two, one of the many problems with the collector class is that they, you know, they buy a surplus and then it just becomes, you know, they love certain
storage.
Things and they show it, but then they have so much stuff in storage. Exactly. That's just sitting there.
Well, that's part, and I'm not patting myself on the back or anything, but I do think part of the reason why I've been becoming friendly and close to a lot of the artists is because they know I really love it. And I think that means a lot to them. And maybe I'll never be the one who can buy out a whole show or support their museum exhibit in Europe or
right.
whatever. You know, maybe I'll never be that collector, but I'm always going to be the one who's still happy with the piece, still grateful that they're alive, still thrilled with what I have. And I think that's important. I still think that's a lot important to a lot of artists.
Yeah. I think,
and that's what makes it fun for me. It really does.
I think you just put the cherry on top of the closing remarks of the speech there.
Well, if there's anything else, call me back anytime, and I do hope we'll get to meet one day.
Absolutely. Thanks so much. Take care.
Thank you.
Bye. Thank you very much again to Stacy for talking to me. I hope you enjoyed that. I think that was very heartening, don't you? All around, very heartening conversation to listen to, very heartening guest to listen to and have. Before we get to some bad advice for the week, let me remind you that the website for this show, once again, is theconversationpod.com. And yes, your support of this show is crucial to keep the show going. So if you would like to become part of the illustrious group of people who have donated to the show, it would be greatly appreciated. Financial donations is where we start. With your support, you can do that by going to theconversationpod.com/support. Leave a nice donation, whatever you can afford, and you will actually get, I don't typically mention this, but as a donating member of $20 or more, you will get the bonus footage with Max Maslansky, among other things that we have waiting for you. You can also support the show non-financially by helping other people find it, either by telling them about it, and or you can go to the iTunes page of The Conversation, which you can look up. If it is linked through the website, but you can also look it up if you're on iTunes. Just look up The Conversation, Unartist Podcast. And if possible, if you would be so kind to leave a 5-star review with some nice comments, it will help more people find the show, which is always appreciated. And there's always social media, Instagram and Twitter at Artist Podcast. And you can become a fan on Facebook, of course, as well. That is appreciated, too. And I love hearing from you. So if you have interesting thoughts about this episode or any other, or future episodes, do weigh in either on social media or you can email the show, which is connected to the site. Thank you very much in advance. Now let's get to some bad advice for the week, courtesy of Catherine Mitchell. The enemy of art is the absence of limitations, Orson Welles. Sorry, I can't go much deeper than that. For you painters out there, we finally got a nice painting quote. You should keep on painting no matter how difficult it is, because this is all part of the experience. And the more experience you have, the better it is, unless it kills you. And then you know if you have gone too far. Alice Neal. Clever. Ironic. Paradoxical. And finally, as my artist statement explains, my work is utterly incomprehensible and therefore full of deep significance. Calvin and Hobbes. Now, you would think that Calvin, the boy of the pair, would have coined that. But, you know, Hobbes, he has known to be very articulate at times. So it could very well have come from Hobbes, although I do kind of picture Calvin saying that. So that's it for Bad Advice. That's it for episode 164. Thank you so much for being here, for your support, for listening, and for your feedback. I appreciate it. We will be back next week with a local to Los Angeles guest who should be quite a bomb thrower, let's just say. So hopefully that will come through. And in the meantime, be well, take care, and thank you very much for listening to the show. Ciao for now.